we did this over and over and over again until finally most of the class began to repeat after him. And after a while, my professor stops and just goes, "See, class, after about 30 or 40 minutes or so, you just memorized Genesis 1:1 in Hebrew. You can do this class." I'll tell you, the biblical languages were the great equalizers in my seminary education. Felt like I was thrown into a lion's den with Greek, where the lion just attacked me. Hebrew was more of just like, I was put into a pen with 1,000 acres of desert, and there was like camels wandering around, and I just kind of wander around aimlessly too, and eventually you figure it out. That's kind of what it felt like there. But, you know, what's interesting is, over time, in my Hebrew class, I started to realize something. I realized that I actually kind of liked Hebrew. Yeah. And after I started to like Hebrew, I started to really enjoy Hebrew. And after I started to really enjoy Hebrew, I really started to grasp Hebrew. And I started to wonder why. Why did I start enjoying this language that was so difficult? Why did I start liking it so much? Well, for many reasons, but for one of the reasons was is because I spent so much time with Greek prior that my mind was able to allow the Hebrew train to choo-choo all the way through my mind, and I was able to grasp biblical languages. Why? Because I spent so much time with something prior that my heart was strangely warm to something else. Or in other words, something I read this week, it said, repetition creates receptivity, and receptivity creates retention. In other words, when my heart is exposed to an idea, over time, my heart can then become open to that idea. And if my heart is open to that idea, then my heart can become loving this idea, can integrate this idea. This is both a terrifying thing and a really good thing for the human condition. But see, this is what Solomon has been doing here in the chapters 5, 6, and 7, what we've been going through these past few weeks. He has been repeating himself over and over again through different mediums so that you could be exposed to the God's truth, so that your heart would be opened and that your heart would integrate and foster receptivity, and that you would cherish what Solomon is having to share with you. And so today, we're in the final chapter of Solomon's theme of adultery. And so we'll go to Proverbs 7. That's where we'll be this morning. And as you turn to Proverbs 7, we'll see this final culmination of repetition that Solomon's giving us to instill in our hearts what he wants us to know and love. So let's look at chapter 7, verses 1 through 5. It'll be on your screen, but also you could follow along in your Bibles. It says, this is Solomon speaking to his son. He says, "My son, keep my words and treasure up my commandments with you. Keep my commandments and live. Keep my teaching as the apple of your eye. Bind them on your fingers. Write them on the tablet of your heart. Say to wisdom, 'You are my sister,' and call insight your intimate friend, to keep you from the forbidden woman, from the adulteress with her smooth words." So Solomon's just repeating what he said in chapters 5 and 6. But Solomon's also doing something quite interesting here. He's giving a little bit of a hat tip or a nod back to Moses back in the book of Deuteronomy, where Moses is instructing Israelite parents on how they are to teach their kids and how they are to walk with their kids and teaching their kids the things of the Lord. Look what Moses says in Deuteronomy 6, telling Israelite parents, he says, "You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit down, when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes." So what Moses is telling us here is, parents, you are the main spiritual authority in your children's lives. In fact, you are God ordained to be the leaders and the teachers and the shepherds of your children. Church, youth group, church camps are all great things and they're essential things, but parents, you are the primary teachers. What that means for you is that you need to know the Lord, you need to love the Lord, and you need to walk with the Lord. But kids, That also means something for you. That means, according to the Bible, that your parents are the ones that you are to submit to. And your parents are given to you as your spiritual leaders to guide you and to shepherd you. So Solomon, in our Proverbs text, he is assuming what Moses has already said. And he's assuming this Moses-like authority while he's talking to his son. And look what he says in verses 2 and 3. Telling his son with this kind of God-ordained authority, he says, "Keep my commandments and live. Keep my teaching as the apple of your eye. Bind them on your fingers. Write them on the tablet of your heart." I mean, look at the verbs Solomon is saying here. Verbs, the things you do. Verbs. He says, keep. Keep these words as precious to you, is what he says. Store. Store these words. Bind. Write. Write these words on your heart. Solomon's end goal isn't just for you to kind of hear these words and to retain these words in an external sense, like a necklace you can put on or take off or a tattoo you can get on your skin. No, he's speaking of an internal retention. An internal retention that's something much deeper within you and something that would naturally then exude out of you because it's so within you. If you actually come to Maggie and I's house, our last name is Sutton, we call it the Sut Hut. If you come to our house and walk down our hallway and go through our kitchen into our pantry, you'll see these large glass sliding doors. And when you slide them open and look into them and you start to spot a theme, that theme that you'll spot in our pantry is aquatic. Things with fins and gills and fishy smells. It's seafood and seafood ingredients. Why? Because seafood is probably Maggie and I's favorite protein. We love fish. And so out of our heart's desire when we go to the grocery store is that we will pick up things that we naturally want. And so out of our desire on the kitchen table, things culminate like extra spicy haddock chowder. Doesn't that sound good on Sunday morning? And in such a greater sense, the wise sage Solomon, he's describing and desiring that we retain his teachings so much that if we were able to crack open your heart and peer into it, we'd see an internal compass that's affixed to God's law. It just exudes God's law. So Moses and Solomon, if they were on, they're on the same second grade playground here. They're swinging the same monkey bars. They're on the same wavelength. They're saying the same thing. They're both giving us an external reminder of how we need an internal guide to spur us on to live wisely and well. Well, okay, Ben, that, to be honest, that doesn't really make much sense. How do we make something external of us, internal inside of us? Well, in one sense, we make external things internal all the time. We ingest medicines to help us to cure bacteria and parasites. We ingest foods to carry us and to nourish us. But we know that's not what Solomon and Moses are speaking of here. Well, how do we know that? Because we remember what Jesus says in Mark 7. It will be on your screen. Jesus talks about this external-internal dynamic. Jesus says, hear me. External things just pass right through them. But Jesus, he gives us the opposite here. He actually says a man is naturally unclean from what is naturally already inside of him. So how does this work then? Moses and Solomon are saying to internalize external things, and that will make you clean. But then Jesus comes in and says, nothing from the outside can make you clean. Doesn't that seem like kind of two opposing statements? Well, perhaps at face value, perhaps it does, but in all actuality, it doesn't at all. They're actually saying the exact same thing. They're both saying that we need something that is outside, even our own outside, to change our internal state. Put another way, we need something distinctly other to change us. We don't need just to ingest medicine. We actually need an entirely new heart. A heart to be translated, transplanted inside of us from something different than us. Because if we got a heart transplant from another human, we'd still have a corrupted heart. We need a supernatural heart change. This just, when you think about it, this just kind of speaks to the human condition, does it not? There's some of us who might think that we can choose to do the right things to be able to get God, or through enough obedience we can feel closer to Him, or we can get closer to Him. But what we're seeing in our text is that Moses, Solomon, and Jesus are all telling us here that that's actually just not correct. Every human heart naturally spews vile things. And so we don't start off as neutral. We actually start off as horrifically corrupted and bent towards oneself. A famous theologian from the 1500s named Martin Luther, he penned this very famous Latin theological term. In Latin, it's incurvantus in se, which means curved towards oneself. And so Luther, he was describing what the Bible already affirms, that our hearts are naturally self-centered. Our hearts are naturally self-focused. Our hearts are naturally self-serving. But don't just take Luther's words at it. Look what the prophet Jeremiah has to say years and years before in Jeremiah 17:9. Look what Jeremiah says about the human heart. He says, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it?" So Houston, we have a problem. And we got a big problem. Perhaps even a bigger problem than you might realize. Our hearts are filled with deceit, pouring out vile wickedness from themselves, and there's nothing internal or external we can do to fix it. But despite this, not being able to fix our sinful hearts, I fear as though we all still want to still kind of escape our sinful realities through different mediums. We try to fix our sinful condition. We try to escape our sinful condition through different things. Here's one way I think some of us try to escape out of our sinful condition. I call it the intellectual pursuit. My junior year of college, I was taking an introduction to philosophy class, and my philosophy professor, he posed a question, and he said, "Class, how do you live life well?" And after he opened it up to the class, we all had discussion from our readings, and we all shared our opinions and our thoughts. And after we had this discussion, he closed down the discussion by saying, "This is the answer, class. In order to live life well, we must be able to know well." And at first hearing this, this sounds good, right? If I just know enough, or if I have enough experience in my life, then I'll be able to see a problem and I'll be able to think my way out of this issue. Or if I read enough good books from people smarter than me, then maybe I'll be able to think through life situations. This one I hear, this is like the banner of my generation, the millennial generation. If I just travel enough, or if I just experience enough cultures in the world, then my mind will be open to how other people think, and I'll be able to think more intelligently and more brilliantly. The huge glaring problem with the intellectual pursuit is that I know way too many people, and you do too, who are seemingly brilliant, profoundly educated, so vastly cultured and well-traveled, and they've made absolute train wrecks of their lives. Our intellect, according to Solomon, Jesus, Moses, Jeremiah, is wholly and completely tainted by our internal sinful condition, meaning we are so permeated by sin that even our own intellect is tainted by sin. Okay, here's the second one. Here's the second way we try to escape our sinful condition, or try to numb the pain of our sinful condition. I call this one the religious pursuit. This one's huge here in Utah. Remember what Jesus says about the greatest commandment found in Matthew 22? It's on your screen. Jesus says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind." So yes, we look at that verse and we absolutely affirm it. We are required to love God above everything else. We are to love the triune God with everything of our being. The problem is you don't. But you might see Jesus' words and you might be tempted to do one of two things. You might hear Jesus' words and use that and go, "Yes, finally, somebody just said it. If you just start doing more things and start doing less bad things, if you just start acting and being more Christian, if you choose to do the right things more and stop doing the bad things more, I am doing that verse." That's one way you could look at that verse. The second one is that Jesus' words might actually be a little bit of a shudder in your heart, because you look at that and you go, "I have to love God with my whole being? I don't know if I can do that." And you're right, you can. But you know, in either response, whether you're excited to do more or the idea of loving the Lord more is a burden to you, they both boil down to the exact same concept: performance. Performance, meaning I just need to put on my pair of religious jogging pants more and start running around the track of religiosity more until I get in good enough shape to eventually work my way up to the religious training grounds to be able to get into the marathon of religion. But in either response, you interpret these words as one and the same. Works, 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 dash in some more works, sprinkle in some more works, and stir that pot of works, because that is what you're doing. So maybe it's not the intellectual pursuit that you are trying to numb your sinful condition. Maybe it's not the religious pursuit that you're trying to numb your sinful spiritual condition. Perhaps it's this one. The apathetic or agnostic pursuit is what I'm calling it. There are some of us in this audience and even watching online who I know are just have a certain numbness to spiritual realities. Or you might just think, "Hey, there's many religions out there. Who's to say Christianity is the right one? Maybe they're all right. Maybe they're all wrong. I'll find out when I die. After all, isn't God a loving God? He'll understand it. He'll get it." Maybe you kind of view it that way. Or, "I'm a good person. I do the good things. I'm living a good life." You know, we all try to escape or numb our sinful condition through intellectualism, through religion, or perhaps apathy or agnosticism. But our Proverbs text this morning, as well as thousands of other biblical texts, give us a corrective to this type of thinking. Look at verses 4 and 5 in Proverbs 7. We already read it, but perhaps you didn't catch it. Look what Solomon says to correct this way of thinking. He says, "Say to wisdom, 'You are my sister,' and call insight, 'Your intimate friend,' to keep you from the forbidden woman, from the adulteress with her smooth words." So it's not knowledge, it's not religion, it's not apathy that will cause you to escape your sinful condition. No, it's actually something different here. Solomon says the solution is love. And he says it's a love for Lady Wisdom. Well, yeah, but he does say to love Lady Wisdom, but he says to love her like a sister. So is this a sibling-like love? Am I to love Lady Wisdom like a brother or a sister? Well, yeah, but as The Price is Right would say, but wait, there's more. As they unveil the curtain, and as we look at Proverbs 8 next week, Lady Wisdom will take on the role of a mother who instructs her children. If we look back to Proverbs 3, if we remember that, Proverbs 3 very clearly describes Lady Wisdom as a lover. So Lady Wisdom is a sibling, she's a parent, she's a lover, she's also a sage. So the corrective here is love and love of Lady Wisdom, and it's love of Lady Wisdom with all of your heart. So we're actually left with a little bit of a cliffhanger here then, because Solomon just leaves us there. And he kind of transitions on to another idea in verse 6. and you're going, holy smokes, I'm getting hungry for some tuna pinwheels for lunch, and we're just now getting to verse 6? Yeah, but here's where this part picks up significantly. So hold your horses. You'll get to those tuna pinwheels or whatever else you're having for lunch here soon, I promise. But before we get to this different idea with Solomon, we need to give a little bit of time for Solomon to step out and take off his sage robe and put on his director's hat. Because in verses 1 through 5, Solomon was acting as a sage. In verses 6 through 23, Solomon's now putting on a play for you. He's going to give you a short play to confirm the point that he's now made. Okay, so while we wait for him to step out and grab a quick refreshing glass of goat's milk, maybe use the restroom, let's recap real quick what he's already told us. Solomon says we need to bind our heart to his words. And when you do, when you bind your heart to Solomon's words, you'll love Lady Wisdom. And if you love Lady Wisdom, you'll be protected from Lady Folly. So Solomon is giving us an anti-example to show you, son, daughter, this is what happens when you don't bind these words of mine to your heart. He introduces this play to show you a real-life example. This is what it means. So look how he introduces his play in verse 7. He introduces the first character, a young man. Look what verse 7 is describing him as. It says, and I have seen him, this is Solomon speaking, and I have seen him among the simple. I have perceived among the youths a young man lacking sense. He's describing this young man as simple, youthful, and lacking sense. And through these poor character traits, so this young man now operates. And then Solomon introduces you to Lady Folly in verses 10 through 13. Look how Solomon describes Lady Folly in verses 10 through 13. He describes her as one who is dressed as a prostitute, wily of heart. She is loud and wayward. Her feet do not stay at home. Now in the street, now in the market, and at every corner she lies in wait. She seizes him and kisses him. Concealment, hidden agendas, sexual enticement, proactivity is what makes up Lady Folly's character here. And then look at what she then tells this simple, naive young man in verse 14 and 15. She tells him, I had to offer sacrifices, and today I have paid my vows. So now I have come out to meet you, to seek you eagerly, and I have found you. She's attaching her sinful motives to something religious sounding here. And this isn't new. Our culture marries its sinful desires to things all the time that sound so good or so religious. Our culture constantly says things like, God wouldn't want you to be unhappy. God would never ask you not to love who you want to love. If you feel you're a certain gender, then you must be that certain gender. God doesn't make mistakes after all. God would never have you put yourself against love, would he? But I'll have you know that Lady Folly is the one who wrote that playbook thousands of years ago. And here's the other thing about Lady Folly. She said she made sacrifices. But do you actually know what she means by that? When I was looking into this and looking through different biblical scholars, kind of figuring out what she means here, everyone's torn. No one actually knows exactly what she means by I have made sacrifices because it's so ambiguous. Is she meaning she's trying to cover up her shame of living a sexually promiscuous lifestyle? That's why she offered a sacrifice? Or is she saying that she became very wealthy and now she is made a sacrifice to leave her husband and to move on and live her life in a different lifestyle? Or is she giving a little bit of a half-hearted nod to Genesis 38, the story of Judah and Tamar? Or perhaps she's even mentioning Leviticus 7, where the Lord talks about how to make sacrifices for sexual sins. The fact that we don't really know what she's meaning, though, I think is quite telling. Is it not? She's brazen and bold, but she's ambiguous. And she says it so convincingly, too, to her very simple-minded audience. She's ambiguous, and she's intentionally ambiguous. ambiguity, when you think about it, it's just a breeding ground for false religion or for false ideology. Just throw in some holy-sounding words, add some Christianese to it, stir it all up in a pot of, and then throw in your requirement for works for salvation, and then boom, bang, booyah, you got a false religion or a false ideology with the ambiguity that breeds in it. So Lady Folly is not necessarily the best individual here. But then even look at verse 17. Lady Folly's not perfect. She kind of slips up and she shares a little bit of her hidden agenda to the foolish man in verse 17. She tells him, I have spread my couch with coverings, colored linens from Egyptian linen. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Myrrh, aloe, cinnamon, those are Hebrew burial spices. And the young man can't even see the casket he's willingly walking into and laying down as she closes the coffin shut. Why? Because he's sexually allured by her. He's a simple-minded, lacking a love for Lady Wisdom kind of man, and he follows exactly what she is luring him to. And we see the culmination of his stupidity in verses 21 and 23. Look what happens in verse 21 and 23. With much seductive speech, she persuades him. Her smooth talk, she compels him. All at once, he follows her, as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as a stag is caught fast till an arrow pierces its liver. A bird rushes into a snare. He does not know that it will cost him his life. This is an intense example. Right when sexual or spiritual ecstasy is to occur in this young man's heart is the exact moment that Lady Folly takes out her dagger and slits his throat. But Lady Folly, she's just playing to what's already in this young man's heart, this foolish man's heart. But also, we know that's also playing into our natural heart as well. You remember what the book of James teaches us about what's in our hearts? Look what James 1, 14 to 15 say about our hearts. It says, but each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. Lady Folly will gladly handhold you to your heart's desires, and when she brings you to your heart's desires, she will let go and step back and smile. She watches you be consumed by your sinful desires and then be eternally killed. That is what will happen. And it's all in our hearts naturally. We all desire selfish, sinful things. So, band, you can come on up now. So at the end of Solomon's play, we're left with almost a sense of disappointment. We see this simple-minded, naive, senseless young man who doesn't love Lady Wisdom, and because he doesn't love her, he follows after Lady Folly, and he's eternally pierced by Lady Folly unto eternal death. But here's the thing. We all naturally are the young, youthful, senseless, simple young man. And so we have to arrive back at this sermon where we began, back to the beginning, where Solomon repeatedly tells us that we need an internal heart change, and that we need to have an internal heart change that would desire Lady Wisdom. But we can't change our hearts through intellectualism. We can't change our hearts through religion. We can't change our hearts through apathy or agnosticism. Instead, we have to get it through something outside of our outside. Or should I say, we have to get this eternal heart change by someone else. And that someone else is the whole point of Proverbs this morning. That someone else who could give you an internal clean heart did come for you. And that someone else took on the form of a body. He took on the form of a servant, though he had heaven's riches. And he was completely and entirely clean from the inside out. But he willingly took on your internal and external sinful heart, though he himself was spotless. And he did it all so that you could be made clean from the inside out. And you can have a heart that exudes love for Lady Wisdom. And the person who did it all, well, we know it. His name is Jesus. And it's Jesus who can give you a new and clean heart. And he'll give it to you if you would but repent and believe in him. And then you could truly love Lady Wisdom. Father, thank you for this time. Thank you for your word. We thank you for how kind and true and faithful you are. And thank you for giving us the internal heart change that we needed through you, Lord Jesus, for those who believe in you. Thank you for how good you are to us. Amen.